We say that the fools rush in where angels fear to tread. I don't know how many angels there are at Sydney University today, and I may be a thorough fool, but this afternoon I'm hoping to do a thing that's really unheard of at Sydney University. I'm going to speak to you about the church, that organised and institutionalised form that those who are Christians have taken over the past 2,000 years in many different tribes, and which, if the Sydney Morning Herald is to be believed, is responsible for most of the ills of today. I'm going to talk about the church, and I'm hoping that you won't gag, that you won't laugh or shout or throw things at me. My wife would appreciate that. But instead, perhaps you will listen and reflect and even understand a little more. At the end of the talk, I'm going to invite you to join us. Actually, to join us. Not to join the church as such, although that might happen too, but to join the one who is the leader and founder of the church, who loves the church, who gave himself up to death for the church, to join him, and therefore to join those of us who are joined to him. The way I want to proceed is to ask and to answer three questions. They're fairly straightforward questions, they're obvious when you think about it, but they need to be answered carefully, and the best way to answer them is to go directly to the horse's mouth, to Jesus himself, the founder and living head of the church. And so for each question, I will refer to an episode from Jesus' life to make it clear what he thinks of the church, which is surely more important than what you or I think. So the first question we want to ask is, what is the church, both empirically, the way it is on the ground, but also theoretically, what it was designed to be? The second question concerns its failures. What is the truth about the failures of the church? We live in a culture which only one prejudice is tolerated, in fact not just tolerated but encouraged. There's one prejudice that you're meant to have in our culture today, anti-Christian bigotry. One commentator wrote that today you can no longer hold up to public ridicule groups such as blacks, indigenous peoples, women, homosexuals, ethnic minorities and so on, and that is rightly so. Those kinds of prejudices are rightly socially condemned. Today, though, the only group that you can hold up to public mockery is, of course, Christians. Attacks on the church and Christianity are common. One author quipped that Christian bashing is one of this country's most popular indoor sports. We need to be just a little bit discerning about the myth and the reality of the failings of the church. But thirdly, we need to ask, what should be done about those failings? What should the church do? What should you do? And it's here that there's a sting in the tail. So there are three questions. It's a pretty straightforward menu. Well, the first question is, what is the church anyway? What is the church anyway? I guess if you ask 10 different people, you get 10 different answers, in large part depending on their different experiences of the church. Maybe someone went to a church school and found a whole regime of Christian studies, lessons and chapel and prayers, etc., etc., a kind of oppressive and stultifying thing. That would certainly influence their understanding of what the church was. Maybe another had nothing to do directly with the church at all. But it picked up various things from the media, say the ABC Religious Affairs Department. And again, if that was a person's source of information, then there's every chance that they would mirror the bias and prejudice embedded in that source. That's why it's important to get the starting point right and to hear from Jesus what he thinks the church is. There is a decisive episode in the accounts of Jesus' public life, what we've come to call the Gospels, where he lays out the charter for the church. Jesus has been conducting a national tour, if you like, moving from place to place, doing his thing, holding rallies and meetings, putting before people his credentials. Now he takes his inner team, his core of associates, for a strategy conference. Way up north in a place called Caesarea Philippi. That's the equivalent of the back of Burke. They arrive, and like many strategy meetings, there's a moment of truth. What is this movement about? What are we trying to achieve? Who are we? Listen to how the interaction unfolds. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" Now, pause there for a moment. The Son of Man is a phrase that Jesus used throughout his public life as a way of referring to himself, but it's also a way which had echoes of a promise that came rumbling down the history of Israel. In the Old Testament scriptures, there was a hope that one like a Son of Man, same phrase, would eventually arrive to rescue Israel from her woes, to throw off her oppressors and establish her as a world power, in fact, as the world power. That was the great hope for Israel. And so in referring to himself in this way, Jesus is picking up those national aspirations. I notice today, Australia has been ranked third in all 177 countries in the world in terms of its lifestyle. I think we're only beaten by, who would you put as the top two countries in the world? Yep, you guessed it, Norway and Iceland. That's it, they win. GDP, education and health. And Australia's third. See, our national aspiration? To hit the top of that list. Well, Israel's national aspiration was nothing short of ruling the world. And Jesus takes that phrase which captured that hope and applies it to himself, but invests it with new meaning. Read on. And they said, in response to his question, "Who do you say the Son of Man is?" Some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, one of the prophets. Now, these are impressive accolades. It's as if someone were to come to you and say that you were Ian Thorpe, Weary Dunlop, and Mel Gibson, all rolled into one. The very highest accolades that could be given to an Australian citizen. But Jesus is not satisfied. Or at least there's another decisive question to ask. He said to them, "But who do you say I am?" This is his team, remember, his disciples. And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. But I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Now notice three things about this decisive interaction. The first is this. The church is founded on, in fact the church really consists of, people who recognize in Jesus not just a spiritual teacher of unsurpassed insight and clarity, although he certainly was that. Not just a champion of the dignity and value of the poor and the oppressed, though he certainly was that too. Those things are not enough. Now the church is those people who see in Jesus the Messiah, God's own anointed and appointed leader. In some wonderful way, the Son of the living God, participating in the very heart and life and identity of God. This is what Peter says, speaking on behalf of the rest of the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. And in response, Jesus says, that is spot on, that is dead right. In fact, this is not something that he has seen on his own. This is something that God himself has illuminated to Peter's heart. It's not just Peter's view, it's not even just Jesus' own view. This is God's own view of Jesus. Anything less than this view of Jesus is inadequate. In fact, anything less than this view of Jesus is blasphemous. Secondly, notice that Jesus has a program here, a plan, a purpose, which is to extend beyond his own lifetime, and that purpose is to build his church. His church, which is founded on this recognition of Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And this band of disciples who've made that recognition. In other words, the church is not just some accident, some wrong turn that people who are hungry for power have made, turning away from the true teachings of Jesus. No, Jesus and his church are profoundly connected. One historian has commented that Jesus came to found the kingdom of God, but what we got instead was the church. And you kind of go, yeah, what shame. Well, no, that's not good enough. That view is inaccurate to Jesus himself. No, he loves the church. He is building his church. He's committed to his church. He has high hopes and plans for his church. Relates to the third point. Notice what the charter of this church is that Jesus is on about. It is a continuation at some level of Jesus' own mission. It's an assault, he says, on the great enemy which stands laughing at humanity. The great enemy which makes a mockery of every person's life and loves. The church is an assault on death itself. It's what Jesus means by the phrase, the gates of Hades. Hades is the place of the dead. And notice that in this all-out campaign, the gates of hell will not prevail. They will not keep out the church. It will launch an attack so powerful, so emphatic, that the gates of death itself will be defeated. That as the church carries the name of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of the living God, to people, so the gates of hell will not prevail. This is a decidedly spiritual campaign. National Israel's aspirations to rule the world are put to one side. You know, Jesus has in mind an even grander thing than that. Death itself to be defeated. It's a campaign for the souls of people, to rescue them from the great enemy that stands against us all, death. It is a mission for life, life in all its fullness, life which drips with love and kindness and humility and sacrifice for the sake of others and generosity. Real life dragged out of real death. This, from Jesus' perspective, is the church. So when we talk about the failings of the church, and we'll come to that in a moment, this is the thing we're talking about. It's built on the recognition of Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It is deeply embedded in Jesus' own plans, so that it just won't do to separate Jesus from the church. It's his church. And it's about doing mortal combat with a mortal enemy, death itself. And Jesus guarantees that of all things, it is the church who will win the victory. Now, I've said that you can't separate the church from Jesus, and that's important. But then again, it's equally important not to make the equal and opposite error. You can't identify the church with Jesus. Immediately after this conversation between Jesus and Peter, it's as though a point of no return has been reached, and so the next step for Jesus takes on a new clarity and determination. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this must never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. This is almost incredible, isn't it? I mean, think about this for a moment. Peter has recognized and articulated what no one else has understood. He has seen Jesus for who he really is, and the next thing Jesus does is call him Satan. By the way, I love this about the Bible. It is a warts and all, no holds barred account of Jesus and his followers. It's just exactly this sort of thing, an unedited version of events that gives you confidence that the biographies of Jesus, the Gospels, are in fact accurate. This is not the kind of thing that you'd make up if you wanted to concoct a fairy tale, is it? The main point here is that Peter can soar like a genius And he can crash and burn like a fool in the space of about 2 minutes. And at this point, it's really important to recognize that although you can't separate the church from Jesus, as though Jesus was just into pious little sayings that were designed to help people live their lives and had no intention to build a thing called the church, but neither can we identify the church and Jesus. Here, on the pages of the Bible, is the church in failure mode, failing its own principles. And yet that doesn't detract from Jesus. In fact, it makes his own integrity and courage and mission all the more impressive. Theologian Tom Wright put it this way: if the church identifies its structures, its leadership, its liturgy, that is its services, church services, its building, or anything else with its Lord, then you get what Shakespeare called the insolence of office. The insolence of office, on the one hand. And on the other, what I see all too frequently, precisely amongst those who bought heavily into this soggy rationalism in the 1950s and 60s, late middle-aged despair. You see how if you identify the Church of Jesus, you either get people seeing themselves as God, the insolence of office, or when it becomes all too clear that that's not the case, then you get soggy middle-aged despair. He says, only when we grasp firmly that the church is not Jesus and Jesus is not the church, are we rescued from hollow triumphalism on the one hand and shallow despair on the other. The truth is that the church is not Jesus, and it is Jesus who is the basis of hope and confidence for the Christian, not the church. In fact, the plan of Jesus is that there will be no church. Eventually. The Jesus who was raised from the dead, who has ascended to God, will return again. He will transform this world, and then there will be no need for a church. Because death itself will finally and at last be destroyed. The church is, you see, an interim arrangement, a kind of holding pen, an airport lounge. It's neither where we've come from, that is, people living their lives without regard to Jesus, but nor is it a destination. Our destination is a rescued and transformed world, a world which in its entirety honours Jesus for who he really is. But still, you see, in the airport lounge, you dress like your destination, not like your departure city, don't you? Say you're sufficiently wealthy to go overseas. Some holidays come. You've done your exams and triumphed. And you leave Sydney in the summer and you get out of New York in midwinter. If you don't have your jacket with you, then you're in big trouble. And the church should look more like its destination than it does. Well, that leads to the second of our questions. Given that this is the church, this is its basis and its mission, what is its scorecard? What is the truth about its failures and its successes? Now, there is a question likely to reveal more about the values of the person answering the question than shed light on the truth of the matter. It's this. Let me give you some examples about this. Here is from Friedrich Nietzsche. I condemn the church. I bring against the Christian church the most terrible of all accusations that an accuser has ever had in his mouth. He was never one to kind of, you know, be backward about coming forward as regards the quality of his own words. It is to me the greatest of all imaginable corruptions. It seeks to work the ultimate corruption, nothing untouched by its depravity. It had turned every value into worthlessness and every truth into a lie and every integrity into a baseness of soul. Ah, now he's on the summit, isn't he? I wish I could have said that myself. What is the specific target of Nietzsche's wrath? Well, it's this. He goes on. This splendid ruling stock. What he has in mind is a herd of blonde beasts of prey, a race of conquerors and masters. what we would come to call the Aryan race. This splendid ruling stock was corrupted first by the Catholic laudation of feminine virtues, secondly by the Puritan and plebeian ideals of the Reformation, and thirdly by intermarriage with inferior stock. That kind of reveals something about Nietzsche, doesn't it? Perhaps more than it does about the church. Hitler's implementation of Nietzsche's ideals resulted in the deaths of 16 million people. I'll give you the other side. Theologian and author and professor at both Harvard and Stanford universities, Michael Novak, wrote this about the gift of human dignity that Christianity has bestowed on the world. Both Aristotle and Plato held that most humans are by nature slavish and suitable only for slavery. Most do not have natures worthy of freedom. The Greeks used dignity for only the few rather than for all human beings. By contrast, Christianity insisted that every single human is loved by the Creator, made in the Creator's image, and destined for eternal friendship and communion with Him. And I think you get a bit of a sense of his own values there as well. I suspect that for every highly credentialed critic with a snappy, quotable quote, you could find an equally highly credentialed defender of the church. It strikes me that this is especially true when we're talking about history, often centuries old history. The temptation to what's called historical anachronism is almost overwhelming. To apply the values and standards and assumptions of our own age and culture to past ages and cultures. I'll give you an example. In a world prior to the development of sophisticated political structures, it was, I think, inevitable that the relationship between state and religion, between religion and state, would be much closer. So much so that for many centuries, to hold a religion different from your king was pretty much the same as treason. And when kings see themselves as appointed by God, and especially see their territorial ambitions as backed by God, whether that be the God of the Christians or the God of Islam, well, you're bound to have a mess, aren't you? The same Dark Ages, with its mix of politics and Christianity that produced the Crusades, could also evoke a comment like this from Professor of History at New York University, Dr. Joseph Reicher. When we contemplate the violence and chaos which attended the disruption of Charlemagne's great empire, and when we recall that distracted and disunited Europe was beset on all sides by enemies, Vikings to the north, Saracens to the south, Magyars and Slavs to the east, we marvel that out of this confusion there arose a great civilization. Throughout these centuries of turmoil, one institution above all others patiently and persistently labored to combat the forces of disintegration and decay. During the era that has long been known as the Dark Ages, it was the Latin Christian Church which succeeded little by little in restraining violence and in restoring order, justice and decency. The distinguished and critical student of the Latin Church has acknowledged that in all the history of humankind, no other institution has exercised so vast an influence on human destinies. Now what are we to make of this historical confusion? I think there are two important points here. The first thing to say is that it is very important not to understate the failures of Christian people and of the church as a body. There have been appalling things done by people who are in positions of trust. There have been equally appalling things left undone, where people had the means and the opportunity to help. Personally, I've had a good experience of the church, and yet even in my good experience, I've experienced bigotry and narrowness in rejection. I've experienced crass stupidity and incompetence. I've seen an insensitivity and arrogance to rival anything in the world. The church has been at the forefront of some of the most shameful episodes in history. The Crusades. But perhaps even worse than the violence by Christians on Muslims was the violence of Christian on Christian, Western Christian on Eastern Christian. The streets flowed with blood. the Inquisition, religious wars, apartheid, and of course, more recently reported in the media, the ongoing uncovering of systematic child abuse. It is only wrong to pretend about these things, to hide them or to seek to cover them up. They are facts and they are a disgrace. A disgrace to the church and a disgrace to the church's God. Actually, this sort of thing is dealt with in the Bible. The Apostle Paul writes about the way that, and I quote, the name of God is blasphemed throughout the world because of you. Speaking to those people who claim to be the people of God. But know, won't you, know carefully that the next thing he says with severe warning in his mouth is that everyone, even those who claim to belong to God, will be held accountable for the way in which they lived. We'll pause. But the second thing to say is the flip side of that first thing. Just as it is important not to understate the failings of the church, so it's important not to overstate the failings of the church. The reason is that when they're overstated, then any response to them, any apology that results, will almost inevitably be insincere. And there's nothing worse than an insincere apology. One way to put this is to say that we need to find a way to untangle ourselves from what you might call institutional naivety. By institutional naivety, what I mean is the view that everyone in any given institution is a reasonable representative of that institution. We manage to avoid institutional naivety all the time. We know that just because some lawyers are treacherous, lying, greedy, ambulance-chasing sharks, that doesn't mean the entire profession is, does it? Or maybe that's not such a good example. But you get the point, don't you? That's brilliantly brought out in an episode of Yes, Prime Minister, that classic British comedy about the foibles of institutions. The Prime Minister is inspecting the most efficient hospital in the country. It scores the highest on every single test. It just happens not to have any patients in it. But the danger here is wanting schools without students. Magnificent places of learning and education. Very smooth, no discipline problems there. A government without politicians. Wouldn't it be terrific if we had government and none of those rotten jolly politicians? And Christianity without churches. Perhaps it's a pleasant fantasy, but of course ultimately it's anemic and lifeless. The fact is that there's a lot done in the name of the church by people who don't recognise in any real sense that Jesus is the Son of the living God. They do it simply as a matter of expediency. I'm no expert in Irish history, but I suspect a lot of the violence and bloodshed of the terrorists, though invoking the name of the church on both sides, had about as much to do with Christianity as it had to do with Islam. It was really about people being manipulated in a vicious power struggle under the guise and in the name of religion. Again, Jesus was plenty cluey enough to know the difference. He himself said, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many deeds of power in my name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you, go away from me, you evildoers." Now don't get me wrong, this is not meant to be a kind of exoneration by smoke and mirrors as though all the atrocities committed in the name of Christianity happened conveniently to have been perpetrated by those who said they were Christians but really weren't. But it is to say that just as it won't do to understate the case, it doesn't help to overstate the case either. The Salem witch hunts were a product of Christians gone mad. Just as the end of legalized slavery was a product of Christians working tirelessly and at their best, and both of those things are true. Both of those things are true. If I had more time, I think I'd do something like what I read about recently. It's about a small student group in the United States. Their kind of version of the EU, they set up a confession booth in the middle of their campus. But it was a confession booth with a difference. They confessed their sins to the students that wandered in. Listen to how the guy who ran the booth describes a conversation with a visitor, a non-church member, to the booth. Yeah, we're confessing to you. I mean, I'm confessing to you. You're serious? His laugh turned to something of a straight face. There's a lot. I'll keep it short. Jesus said to feed the poor and to heal the sick. I've never done very much about that. Jesus said to love those who persecute me. I, says this Christian, I tend to lash out, especially if I feel threatened, you know, if my ego gets threatened. Jesus did not mix his spirituality with politics. I grew up doing that. I got in the same way of the central message of Christ. I know that was wrong, and I know that a lot of people will not listen to the words of Christ because of people like me who know him, carrying our agendas into the conversation rather than just relaying the message Christ wanted to get across. There's a lot more, you know. The visitor's name was Jake. It's all right, man, Jake said very tenderly. His eyes were starting to water. Well, I said, clearing my throat, I'm sorry for all that. I forgive you, Jake said. And he meant it. Thanks, I told him. He sat there and looked at the floor, then into the fire of a candle. It's really cool what you guys are doing, he said. A lot of people need to hear this. Have you heard a lot of people, I asked him. We haven't heard me. I just think it isn't very popular to be a Christian, you know, especially at a place like this, a secular university. I don't think too many people have been heard. Most people just have a strong reaction to what they see on television, all those well-dressed preachers supporting the Republicans. That's not the whole picture, I said. That's just television. I have friends who are giving their lives to feed the poor and defend the defenseless. They're doing it for Christ. You really believe in Jesus, don't you? He asked me. Yes, I do. Most often I do. I have doubts at times, but mostly I believe in him. It's like there's something in me that causes to believe. I can't explain it. You said earlier that there was a central message of Christ. I don't really want to become a Christian, you know, but what is that message? And on they go. And that guy in the confession booth probably has the first real conversation with a Christian about Christianity that he's ever had. The church, and that means regular Christians like lots of the people in this room, like me, has failed. We've failed in our care for others. We've failed to serve the world with passion and sacrifice. Maybe even more importantly, we've failed our own Lord, the one who's created us and made us his own church. In a sense, if you feel disappointed in the church, if you feel even anger towards the church, think for a moment how Jesus must feel. We have failed, which is why there's only one way forward, which is to go back to the beginning. And that leads us to our third question, dealing with failure. Well, if you've been following what I've said so far, then you're a little clearer, I hope, on what the church is. We're a little clearer on what its failures are. The question is now to figure out, in a sense, how to move forward. I'll look at one final episode from the life of Jesus, which I think speaks powerfully to the situation. Now, the scene is just outside the Jerusalem walls at a place called the Mount of Olives. While Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, you see, early in the morning, verse 2, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say? They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Now, pause there just a moment. This is a scene that would make great television, isn't it? The tension is massive. As many questions are left unasked as they are asked. How exactly does a group of blokes catch a woman in the very act? Did they set her up? They sort of drew straws for who would do it? Did they stake her out? You may not even think adultery is that big a deal. But at least hardly deserving of the death penalty. Of course, that's an expression of your values. If that's the case, change the crime then. Say she was caught in the act of pedophilia, child sexual abuse. Feel the anger rise within you. Put yourself in Jesus' shoes. What are you going to say? Well, listen and learn. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. And when they heard, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with a woman standing before him. Jesus knows that he's got two issues to deal with. On the one hand, there's the adultery or the abuse or whatever it is. On the other hand, there's the hard, accusing hearts of the men around her. He deals with them in reverse order. His first response is to the accusers, and it is brilliant. "Let anyone without sin be the one who is first to cast a stone." And so they pause, and they drop their rocks, and they leave. And did you notice the detail? The oldest, most responsible, most respectable first. Presumably because it's most apparent to them that they are far from being without sin. And then he deals with the woman. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." It's clear that the accusers are in no position to condemn. And more importantly, Jesus chooses not to condemn. That is his heart. But nor does he condone, notice. He calls it what it is, a sin, a crime. He commands her to go and sin no more, to turn her back on that life. Now, in a sense, that's a picture of an individual, perhaps even of you as an individual, and you hope like crazy that if you're caught like that, that God would treat you like that. But what I want to suggest is that in another sense, it's also a picture of the church. He's the church, you see, cowering on the ground, caught in the act. There's no doubt about her guilt. Accused by dozens, hundreds, millions of people circling around it. Perhaps even accused by you today. And one of the things that Jesus has to say to you, you see, is this. "Let anyone who is without sin cast the first stone." And so a question I want to put you today is this. What are you going to do with your stone? You. What are you going to do with your accusation? Of course, hear what Jesus says to the church. "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Let's take it one step further. The next scene, now this bit's not in the Bible, right? The next scene opens a month later, and you see the same woman and you ask how she's going. What might she say to you? Does she say, "Hey, look at me. I'm now a perfect person. One quick instruction from Jesus and I'm cool"? Now I suggest that she says, I suggest the church says, what I say to you today is this. "Hey, don't look at me. Look at the one who had mercy on me. I didn't deserve it, that's for sure. I couldn't really have hoped for it, but he gave it. And for that I'm thankful with all my heart. Mind you, it's not easy. I'm still a recovering addict. I'm a recovering sin addict. And it's hard as hell to break the habit. I'm trying. But I can't wait till Jesus comes back and fixes up this mess that the world is in. In fact, the longer I go on, the more I realize just how much I need mercy in my life. And then I suspect you'd say something like this. Hey, tell me something. I recognize you from that day, don't I? You didn't throw a stone then, did you? In fact, you were one of the first to drop your stones. And I'm wondering, maybe you're an addict too. Maybe you need mercy like I need it. You know something? If you ask, he'll give it to you. Just like he gave it to me. He won't condemn, but he will help. And he will command. You know what he said, go and sin no more. And if you do ask, then maybe we can be recovering addicts together. We have meetings, you know, kind of like AA. We meet on Sundays, 10 o'clock. The one I go to is in Ashfield. It's called church. Now, the failings of the church don't constitute the failure of God. They are real, and the church and Christians and I ought to do better. That's true. But if the church was all that God had to offer, then sure, the failings of the church would be the failure of God. But the church is not what God is offering to the world. Jesus is what God offers to the world. And the church is that collection of recovering addicts that knows more than anything else in all the world that they need what God offers. Mercy in the present and a renewed world under the wonderful, powerful authority of Jesus in the future. Maybe you know that too. And I want to invite you to do what that woman and what all of us who are Christians here today have done ourselves and would say to you, call out to Jesus for mercy. Know that you too are an addict. And that when it comes to launching accusations, actually, you're not without sin either. I want to lead us in a prayer. There's nothing magic about the prayer. It's just some words that express the things that we've talked about today. I invite everyone to pray with me, whether you're in the church or not, frankly, because we all need mercy from God. We all need the forgiveness of Jesus. We all need the power of Jesus to return and to fix this world up, to take us to our destination. Why don't we bow our heads and close our eyes and in the quietness of our own hearts and minds pray together. Gracious God, we see failure all around us. In institutions, in governments, in the church, and if I'm honest, even in myself. Thank you that you have given Jesus to provide mercy now and to return again. Establish the world in life and peace without sin or death. Please have mercy on me now and help me to start living that life that you call me to. I pray in Jesus' name.